25-1093, United States versus Eugene William Austin Jr.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Peter Tamayo. I represent Eugene Austin. Your Honor, the issues on this case is that the district court erred in admitting evidence at trial regarding over Mr. Austin's objections and in sentencing Mr. Austin to 18 years in prison. We argue that the court erred in several ways in sentencing Mr. Austin. First, procedurally by denying his motion to relieve his trial counsel. Second, by considering information in the case that was outside the record, namely regarding his son, Brandon. And thirdly, and this is our principal issue, in imposing an 18-year sentence on a 62-year-old man, which effectively amounted to a life sentence in a fraud case.
What were the guidelines?
The guidelines, Your Honor, were finally with 262 to 327 months.
And was the sentence above or below the guidelines?
Oh, it was certainly below. It was 216 months, so it was 46 months below the minimum bottom of the guidelines, which is a substantial reduction.
It makes it substantially harder for you to argue that this was a
I recognize that
substantively too high.
I recognize that, except for what the impact was. The impact was to place this person in a situation where he's likely to be arrested when he's approximately 80 years old.
I guess, sir, if someone were caught shoplifting a stick of gum, then that would be a sympathetic argument. But this was an incredible series of frauds. So aren't we also obliged to defer to the district court's assessment of the seriousness of the crime and Mr. Austin's culpability and the need for deterrence? He seemed rather undeterred and just rolling forward year after year after year with, you know,
well,
all of these.
Certainly it's a series of crimes, but deterrence would come, you know, from the conviction, Your Honor, and not from the fact that he was conducting this series over time.
Well, the deterrence would come from the sentence.
From sentence, of course. But I'm saying, when you say
the judge is trying to figure out, I gotta tell this guy to knock it off.
Well, certainly, Your Honor, and we're not arguing that he ought to get probation. The recommendation of probation department, and which was the basic request made by his defense counsel, was 10 years.
Well, we've said expressly that a district court's deviation from a probation recommendation is not a basis for impugning a sentence, right? We've said that expressly.
We certainly have, and I cited that in my brief.
But they owe zero deference to the probation department because they're not the people who sentence people. So that's not an argument that carries any water for you, right?
I understand, Your Honor. What I'm saying is we're not discussing the difference between probation and 18 years. We're discussing the difference between the recommendation that we were seeking, which was 8 to 10 years, different variations on it, and the 18 years. There's a big difference for a person of this age in the difference between those 8 years.
Can I ask you to direct your attention to you also complained about the evidentiary rulings?
Yes.
Could you look at page 24 of the blue brief?
Of my brief?
Yeah, please. I want to make sure I have the right copy of it. Just tell me when you're there.
Yes.
So there's a heading starting B. The lower court's rulings resulted in unfair prejudice to Mr. Austin. I just want to make sure we're on the same place. The paragraph starts by admitting evidence of the dot, dot, dot.
I saw that typo when I was reading the brief
and
for preparation.
So I read through the rest of the brief, and I never understood what was supposed to be in the dot, dot, dot. I didn't ever see any argument pointing to particular evidence that was admitted. and an explanation of why admission of that evidence, say, was prejudicial to your client or not probative or whatever it might be. And I was left to look at the recitation of facts and guess what that might be.
I understand your
argument. So I'm just curious what the nature of the argument was supposed to be.
Well, Your Honor, as you noted in our reply brief, we drew on the arguments made by the government that they recognized that one of the issues we had was the use of the tax return information.
Okay, so and that was supposed to be about the tax returns.
That's what, for the purposes of the argument, Your Honor, that's what we're asking, the tax return information.
The tax returns. And what, just explain to me what's the problem with the tax returns?
Look, they were totally irrelevant to the case, Your Honor. There was no
relevance for a one.
No, and that the 403, that any relevance they have would have been outweighed by the potential for unfair prejudice.
Well, as I understand the government's position, they're suggesting they're not irrelevant because the failure to pay taxes on this money shows that he was trying to conceal the illegal source of the money or the illegal context in which the money was earned and dealt with. Seems to be a sensible argument, Mr. Tamayo. What am I missing?
Well, it wasn't introduced for that purpose, Your Honor. It was introduced for a purpose of intent and knowledge.
Right, that's consciousness of guilt. Isn't that mental state?
That he was aware that he was involved in illegal activity because in addition to engaging in the activity, he then concealed the earnings on his tax returns. That's the argument. Why isn't that a permissible conclusion for the district court to support a district court admitting the evidence?
Well, Your Honor, because in this case, there's an argument that he in fact didn't have any income from that was improper, that was fraudulent operations.
Right, the argument is that he was making money off the victims and didn't want to tell the government because then he'd be letting onto the world that he had all this money he had stolen. The loot. That's a very sensible argument to make, no?
But how is it hot? I don't see how it's hiding
the IRS poking around in your affairs. If you're stealing money hand over fist, the last thing you want to do is reveal it to anybody, particularly the IRS, who can start looking at you and saying, I don't know, something looks fishy about where you got the money.
But he's revealing it isn't being hidden. He's entering into written agreements with these individuals. This is all being done, you know, openly. It's not being done in the...
Why didn't he report that income? If it was all legit, why didn't he report it?
Well, he probably didn't want to pay taxes on it, Your Honor.
Okay.
I mean, that's a separate issue from whether or not
argument, right? That it comes in, the government says he's trying to hide it from the IRS because it's all illicit and he's trying to hide illicit activity. And then the defense says, no, jury, please draw the opposite inference. It's just that he's a tax cheat.
But our argument is that it should never have gotten to the jury.
But my
point
is,
outside
it
the,
seems
the
like
once it's
there
coming
are
in,
arguments to be made on both sides. And how do we say that the district court abused his discretion in saying, yeah, you know what, this is arguable. There's an inference that could be drawn fairly either way. It would be rational either way. Let the jury figure it out.
Because
what 403 is about, right?
Well, the judge is also supposed to act as a gatekeeper as to what information is getting to the jury so that they can be decisive.
Well, that's what I'm saying. If there's a plausible inference that could be drawn either way, then the judge is doing a good gatekeeping job by saying, yeah, this is the kind of thing juries sort out.
I understand, Your Honor, but in this case, we believe that was not properly drawn.
Why don't we hear from the government?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Olga Zverevich for the United States. I represent the government on appeal, as I did in the district court below. The judgment of conviction should be affirmed. With respect to Mr. Austin's challenge to his conviction, his argument that Judge Castell somehow abused his discretion in admitting the tax evidence is waived because Mr. Austin did not present that argument in any way, shape, or form in his opening brief. The only place in which it's mentioned is the procedural background section of the brief just describing the case, and the tax evidence was not mentioned either in the statement of issues or in the argument section. For that reason, it's waived. Even if the court were to reach that issue, that challenge is meritless because under this court's inclusionary approach to Rule 404B evidence, Judge Castell acted well within his discretion in admitting evidence that Mr. Austin failed to report or pay any taxes on the proceeds that he received from the scheme for the proper non-propensity purpose of showing his consciousness of guilt.
Can I ask you about the other evidence that I thought might have been raised in the blue brief on the evidentiary challenge? And it was what he describes as, let's call it the other act evidence. My understanding is that to the extent, perhaps, that the defense is referring to evidence that was covered by the pretrial motion in limine ruling, that the government ultimately didn't present that evidence in the end. Is that right?
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
Or is there some slice of it that was admitted that I'm missing?
No, Your Honor, none of it was admitted. So that part of the Rule 404B motion sought to admit pre-2017, so pre-charged conspiracy conduct relating to six specific victims of the offense. And at the trial, the government did not call any of those victims at all, not to mention elicit any testimony about pre-2017 conduct. Okay, so that issue is fully moot. So
it's not really moot so much as meritless, right? I mean, if you're now complaining about it, we just say there was no harm. There was no error because it was never admitted.
There was no error.
Mootness is sort of an odd term.
I think multiple different doctrines apply here. I think there is no error. If there was an error in a theoretical way, it's harmless because the evidence was not, in fact, admitted. We also do think it's moot because a favorable ruling from this court would not grant any effectual relief to Mr. Austin.
Well, no, if we ruled in his favor and overturned it, then he would win. It would be dumb for us to do it. There's no merit. There's no reason for us to do it, but it doesn't seem like he can't get effectual relief. We could, if we bought his argument. I think the point is not that we can't grant relief, it's that there's no basis for granting relief.
I see Your Honor's point on that. I think what we meant was that Mr. Austin would be in the same position vis-a-vis this challenged evidence, that he couldn't admit, it wasn't admitted before and it wouldn't be admitted now, but I see Your Honor's point. Uh-huh. Mr. Austin's sentencing challenges are also meritless. With respect to the substantive reasonableness challenge, Judge Castell acted well within his discretion in determining that the nature of Mr. Austin's conduct here warranted the below-guideline sentence that he imposed, which was 18 years, which was nearly 4 years below the bottom of the guidelines range. In imposing that sentence, Judge Castell emphasized several factors, including that Mr. Austin caused $12 million in actual real losses to individual victims. Approximately 26 different victims were identified. Judge Castell noted that in some fraud cases, loss sort of overstates the true nature of the harm, but that in this particular case, quote, every penny of that $12 million loss was richly and directly attributable to Mr. Austin. There were victims who testified at trial and who also submitted victim impact statements describing that Mr. Austin's crimes caused not just financial, but also lasting emotional damage. Judge Castell also emphasized that while this was Mr. Austin's first conviction, the fraud was very extensive. The charge scheme spanned from 2017 to 2021. If you look at relevant conduct described in the pre-sentence report, it goes back to 2012. So this was really a decade of fraud. Judge Castell also emphasized Mr. Austin's utter lack of remorse and acceptance of responsibility. Mr. Austin delivered very lengthy remarks to the district court, all of which were focused solely on himself, without acknowledging the pain of the victims. There was also an acute risk of reoffending and therefore incapacitation that Judge Castell focused on. And finally, Mr. Austin was a leader in this offense. He used his own son and got him involved in the offense and regularly provided instructions and orders to his son in connection with the scheme. All of these factors warranted the sentence that Judge Castell imposed, and there was certainly no abuse of discretion. Unless the court has any further questions, the government rests on its brief.
No, thank you very much. Mr. Tomeo, if you would like, you have reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to start where prosecutor left off, which is in the issue of Mr. Austin's statement to the court at sentencing, to which the judge seems to have taken particular offense. The sentencing judge pointed to him having no empathy and no remorse, but Mr. Austin at the time was still maintaining his innocence. He had gone to trial, he had pled not guilty, had been convicted after trial, and he should not have been penalized for not admitting his guilt at sentencing. Now, if he had admitted his guilt,
can a district judge credit someone who does express remorse at sentencing? Can they give him a lower sentence for that?
Of course, and we've often argued that.
So, I guess I'm not understanding why then we would fault the district judge for not giving a lower sentence. You're saying the judge went up from a different sentence the judge had in mind?
The judge.
Or just didn't go down.
The judge, in terms of his calculus, had taken into account the fact and made an argument, and in his statement of his reasons, spoke at length about the lack of empathy that
Isn't remorse or the lack of remorse part of the nature and characteristics of the defendant?
Of course it is, but it was taken into account.
Why shouldn't or why can't a district judge take lack of remorse into account?
Well, it is taken into account in the fact that he wasn't getting points off the guidelines for acceptance of responsibility.
You see, it's a below guideline sentence. So I understand your argument. If the judge had affirmatively aggravated for this, but we have no basis in this record to think that there was any affirmative aggravation. We just know that the district court, in explaining it and in imposing a non-guideline sentence, was mentioning a factor that certainly didn't weigh in your client's favor. Why isn't that what the record reveals, opposed to some error?
Well, the record reveals that the judge had taken into account the fact that Mr. Austin was maintaining his innocence, even at sentencing, which he had an absolute right to do.
Okay.
And that's what I'm saying was the error, Your Honor. I don't think you can separate the calculus from the calculus and start saying, well, because it's a non-guideline sentence.
Acceptance of responsibility would get someone under the guidelines credit. You're saying the district judge cannot say there's been no acceptance of responsibility in this case?
I'm saying that it can't be added as an aggravating factor.
Right. Now, where is the evidence that it was an aggravate, that it aggravated the sentence beyond what it would otherwise have been?
Well, because we're saying, Your Honor, that it does, because the sentence was as severe as it was in connection with the age of this particular defendant at this time.
Cervich, cite the many, many factors that Judge Castell spoke about for why he thought a sentence at this range, albeit below the guidelines, was nevertheless warranted. What makes you think that all those factors wouldn't have supported this sentence, even if the judge had never mentioned your client's failure to accept responsibility?
I don't think you can deconstruct a sentence and take out particular factors and say, okay, we'll forget about that. What would have happened? I think that given the nature of what the judge said at sentencing, it's very clear that that was a very motivating factor in terms of what sentence he gave Mr. Austin. I mean, the idea that Mr. Austin was going to come out of prison in his 70s and just start up again you know, is just, there's no basis for that at all in any kind of fact. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
We reserve the order of arguments.
Thank you to both counsel, and we will take the case under advisement. Have a